I'm Lisa Fine, and I'm one of the co-hosts of the Great Women in Compliance podcast. You are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report. Check out Great Women in Compliance on the Compliance Podcast Network, and it posts every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. You can also join in the conversation at the GWIC community on LinkedIn as well.
In this episode, fan favorite and Morrison & Forster partner, James Koukios, joins me to take a look at several issues which were discussed in the Morrison & Forster International Anti-Corruption Newsletter from March. The FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back for another episode. Today, I have back with me fellow University of Michigan grad, James Koukios, partner in Morrison & Forster. Today, we're going to talk about the firm's always great March International Anti-Corruption Newsletter. So, James, first of all, welcome back. Go blue. So, James, you had in spite of the dearth of FCPA cases and recognizing, of course, that the newsletter is more internationally focused, I thought you had some really interesting matters from the March one. So let me just jump right into it. We had a Scottish oil and gas company resolving Kazakhstan bribery allegations in the courts in Scotland. We rarely see Scotland prosecuting bribery and corruption. So I was wondering if you had some thoughts on why is Scotland doing this prosecution as opposed to the Serious Fraud Office or a court in another court in Great Britain?
Yeah, good question, Tom. So just a little background. Yep. As you said, we saw the Scotland's prosecutor service bring a case against a subsidiary of John Wood Group PLC. And of course, John Wood Group has had, after March and other times, has had other resolutions, including with the SFO. But it seems to me that this one is because this particular subsidiary was actually based in Aberdeen. And so, you know, maybe because of that in particular, this was a Scottish case instead of an SFO case. You're right, though. It's not that common for the Scottish prosecutors to bring a case, but it's also not unheard of. I went back to some of our older alerts and I saw, you know, in April of 2016, for example, the same prosecutorial service from Scotland announced that they had brought a UK Bribery Act case against a Glasgow-based logistics company. And they had actually done another resolution in September of 2015, another UK Bribery Act resolution that time as well. And so my guess is, these just happened to be companies that were part of, based in Scotland. And so whatever division of labor they have or agreements they have there. Scotland went forward with those. And then when it seems like a couple months later, when the company was more based in other parts of the UK, the SFO went forward as well. But it is an interesting development.
So James, we had a Serious Fraud Office investigation end, and it was into bribery allegations around KBR. UK Serious Fraud Office lost an appeal to the UK Supreme Court around document production and subpoenas issued to KBR. But I was wondering if you saw really any greater significance into the SFO ending its investigation, or almost, I don't want to say routine, but, you know, they looked into it, didn't find something there, or didn't feel like they could prosecute it and close their books.
The significance that I see for this is that back in August of 2020, the SFO had informed KBR that it had shut down part of its investigation, in particular the part involving Unioil. So that's actually two Unioil cases we talked about in a row, because the Kazakhstan case we just talked about was also related to Unioil. But back in August of 2020, the SFO told KBR, you know, we're done with the Unioil part of the investigation, but we're still investigating some other things about you. And then just a couple months later, about 6 months later or so, in February of 2021, the UK Supreme Court held in KBR versus SFO that the SFO cannot use its statutory power under the Criminal Justice Act to require a non-UK company that does not have a registered office or carry out business in the UK to produce documents from abroad. And my inference, I don't know this for sure, but I find it very interesting that 1 month later, after the Supreme Court of the UK says, you know, SFO, you can't use this tool to go get evidence against KBR for whatever KBR was still investigating, the SFO decides to shut down the investigation. You know, when we had covered the Supreme Court decision before, we did note that it was likely to have an effect on SFO cases. Obviously, now, you know, if the SFO is able to compel documents from overseas from companies, rather than going through the very complicated and time-consuming mutual legal assistance treaty request process, that would make cases more complicated. It's just harder to get evidence that way. You don't have compulsory process in the same way that you would if there's a direct order, things like that. Now, the SFO will most likely use MLAT requests in these cases because of this ruling, but it seems to me that it had a direct impact on the remaining part of the KBR case. And so they felt like, you know, without that evidence that they could no longer get because of this Supreme Court ruling, they had to close the case. So in short, Tom, to me, this signals that this Supreme Court ruling and the limits on the SFO's ability to compel evidence from overseas, it is going to have an effect on SFO cases going forward. And companies and their defense counsel will very much want to monitor how the SFO reacts to this decision and whether it is going to complicate investigations for them.
James, turning to an older case that I think had a lot of significance at the time that it came out, the former CFO of the New York-based hedge fund, which formerly was known as OCZIF, was ordered to pay a civil penalty. The OCZIF case, I think, was also from the similar year of 2016. And I wondered if we might use this right up in the March newsletter to maybe reflect upon the legacy or significance of OCZIF and kind of from where you sit as a former FCPA unit member and now as part of the defense bar. Do you have any real thoughts on the significance of OCZIF?
Yeah, I have two thoughts on that, Tom. Thanks for asking about that. Number one, you know, this was really one of the first, if not the first, of the big financial institution cases that DOJ and SEC made. You know, I think for a long time, people did not see the financial services industry as being particularly high risk for FCPA. You know, I think most people thought of FCPA risk as extractive industries, government contracting, you know, defense contracting, and maybe pharmaceutical and medical device. And the enforcement agencies really, you know, made a point of saying, you know, no industry is FCPA risk free. As long as you do business internationally, there, you know, there's a potential risk. And this was really the kind of the first in the push of the financial services industry. It was also very large. I think at the time that it came out, it was the fourth largest FCPA resolution of all time. Now with inflation, I don't even know if it's the top 10. You know, the FCPA penalty numbers are now, it used to be when we would get $100 million, that was a huge case. Now $100 million is a small case, and $1 billion is a big case. So a $400,000 one didn't seem so big nowadays, but at the time it was big. So you kind of had an industry that was newly in the crosshairs of the enforcement agencies and a record-setting penalty at that. I think the second part that's interesting is that they were also able to make, at least the SEC was able to make cases against individuals as well. You know, that's one thing that the enforcement agencies always say they want to do is not just bring corporate resolutions, but also bring individual resolutions. Interestingly enough, the reason we're talking about this now is that this is one of the individuals that SEC announced that they had charged back in 2016. But at the time, for whatever reason, they hadn't decided on the amount. The announcement was that he had agreed to resolve this, but that the amount would be determined later. And here we are, 5 years later, almost 5 years later, 4.5, I guess, with the penalty finally being assessed. And it was frankly pretty small. it was $35,000. So, you know, I don't know why it took so long, but it ended up not being very high. But point being, they still did go after individuals and were able to resolve with them. So I think the new industry, the large amount and being able to bring individual cases were a pretty big aspect of the OCSIF. What do you think, Tom?
Andrew Sarinsky, I heard him talk in the ACI's FCPA annual conference that year, and he was going through his wrap-up, and he spent some amount of time on OCSIF because it really was significant. The $400 million did put it in the top 10 at that time. It no longer is in the top 10. But also, certainly from his perspective, it showed that both the SEC and Department of Justice would go literally to the very top because the CEO had to pay a penalty at that time. The other thing is the follow-on litigation that has come out of OCSIF. There were identifiable parties who lost bids to obtain mineral rights and extractive mineral rights because of the bribery of OCSIF, and they were able to prove that in court, and they were able to persuade the Department of Justice if not support, not oppose their claims. And so this was one of the first times we'd seen aggrieved third parties been able to bring claims, essentially tortious interference claims, against a company who had settled an FCPA case, and that case was that company was OCSIF. So really, for those two points as well, some unique facts and legal situations that came out of this. But the starting point that you began with, James, that this was really the first of the investment bank cases where many people, if they didn't think that the FCPA applied to them, there certainly were not cases of any size brought before OCSIF, and that I think woke up a lot of people in the hedge fund industry.
And good point on the victim issue. That was a very unusual development, and now, you know, just recently we see Ericsson resolving with a competitor following an FCPA resolution, and you got to wonder, is that another case, relatively rare, where they were able to show a direct impact on a real victim? Because most of these cases, you know, when I was at DOJ, we took the position that they were victimless. Obviously, society was a victim, but you couldn't identify specific victims. And I believe, Tom, if I remember correctly, that was DOJ's initial position in the OCSIF case, but the judge made it clear that he did not agree with that. And then DOJ changed its position, as you mentioned, if I recall correctly.
James, I've often wondered, tortious interference is a well-known state civil tort in the state of Texas, and tortious interference with contract. And so I've often wondered why aggrieved parties to, you know, submitted a bid or had some sort of tangible evidence that they had lost out because of bribery or corruption really hadn't brought that type of litigation. But I guess I remember that the company was able to present information to the DOJ, which also helped, I think, cause them to change their position. But nevertheless, however that happened, we don't see it often, but we now have a couple examples of it in the Ericsson case is well put as well.
We'll be right back with more James Koukios after this message.
I want to close, James, with we had an unusual case in many respects, a criminal prosecution in Italy. Prosecutors brought a claim against the former CEO and former CFO of ENI over allegations of bribery that ENI and joint venture partner Shell had engaged in Nigeria. And the facts of this case were a little different than we typically see, certainly in an FCPA case, because both Shell and ENI, and indeed the former CEO of ENI, had authorized payment to the government of Nigeria for a block grant of rights offshore Nigeria. It was clear to all parties, prosecutors included, that this payment was made to the Nigerian government, but it was clear to both ENI and Shell, because we have their internal correspondence, that this they were both afraid this money would be used to pay bribes once it was paid to the Nigerian government. It was paid to the Nigerian government. It went to one former oil minister, Dan Etienne. And Mr. Etienne kept some of the money after he left government and distributed other parts of the monies to other Nigerian government officials. One of the things that the strongest tenets of the FCPA is it is illegal to make a payment to a foreign government official, not a foreign government. And I've counseled many, many clients over the years that, if you write your check out to the government of Nigeria, that's going to be okay. If you write it out to Mr. Oil Minister as agent for the government of Nigeria, that's a different story. So, but the prosecution was not successful, but it did, I think, raise a lot of concerns in certainly the extractive industry, who plays extensively in West Africa, but also I think for compliance officers generally, because it's certainly one thing to have a compliance program in place to prevent payments to an individual, but it's very different to have to get some sort of assurance from a foreign government that they won't use the money you pay them for mineral rights in any way they deem appropriate. And even if that happens to include they use that money to pay as bribes, it's a level that we haven't had to do in the compliance world, and I'm not sure we could do it. But I was wondering if maybe you had some thoughts on that or kind of this case in general.
No, you raise really good points. I mean, as a baseline, you're right. Typically, money paid to a government is not an FCPA violation because the money has to be paid to a government official, exactly what you said. And I think, you know, to try to implement some kind of almost third-party due diligence of the government for all these things to make sure that the money is not being misspent probably is not practical and probably would not be the best use of compliance resources in most cases. You do have the exception. Of course, we had the UN Oil for Food program, where the allegations there were that the bribes and kickbacks were to the Iraqi government. And DOJ brought wire fraud charges there instead of FCPA charges. Again, acknowledging that it could not be an FCPA violation technically, but there was a certain level of proof that they knew that this money was going to be used improperly, or was being used improperly somehow. Maybe that's something, but still, I'm not sure that warrants additional resources unless you know that this is a risk of your industry or there's some reason to believe in a particular transaction that's the case. I do remember once when I was a FCPA prosecutor, it's a much smaller and different kind of issue, but we were investigating a company where the company had given multiple, I believe it was TV sets, to a small police department in a obviously a non-US country. And our question was, look, you know, why would the police department itself need that many television sets? Did you know that this was, did the company know that this these TV sets were not going to stay at the police department, but they're going to go home with the police officers? And did you do anything to make sure that the television sets stayed there? You know, that again is kind of a very specific situation where the facts, it turns out that there, you know, we never brought that case and I think we satisfied ourselves that it wasn't the case. I think there was some follow-up by the company that the TV sets were there or something. But, you know, that might be a case where there's a specific reason to look into the transaction and to believe that the money was going from a government to, as the government, the thing of value going to the government was actually a cover for a bribe. But I think, Tom, you're right. In the vast majority of circumstances, that is going to be too much to do in a compliance program. What do you think? Is there anything that companies can do?
I really don't see it. I first of all, you're actually right on the performing due diligence, but I really have focused on the managing the relationship after the money's paid. And I just kind of think of one practical way to do that. I mean, even if that was the U.S. law telling a foreign government, no, you can't use the money, in a way that will violate U.S. law. That just, to me, goes against sovereignty in many different ways, shapes, and forms. So I just see a lot of impracticability. But this case, you know, once you have one case, it's one lesson I've learned. There, somebody may follow that case, and there may be a precedent created, even if the prosecution in Italy was not successful, and that others may try a similar legal argument in another venue that might be successful. Then you've got a successful precedent, and things kind of roll on from there. So something that I want to keep watching.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I'll just add one James, more thing, Tommy. I was going to add one more thing, Tom, and it kind of goes with my television set. I have heard DOJ and SEC, when it comes to charitable giving to institutions like hospitals, that they expect there to be some kind of follow through to make sure that the machine that was being donated or whatever it may be to the hospital was not being used in private practice. So there may be a little bit of about that already for some enforcement attorneys thinking that. But I think, you know, when it comes to a charitable giving, there probably are already safeguards built into many compliance programs to make sure that the money was being used appropriately, because people don't want to give, you know, they want to make sure that the charitable giving is going to the right place. So maybe it's sort of analogous, but maybe different enough from what you're talking about that it's not a true expansion of any kind of compliance requirements.
Really, and I don't think it's an expansion, because typically, even if it's a hospital or other instrumentality, it's not a foreign sovereign, and you can, particularly with a hospital or other charitable entity, there are ways to manage that relationship after the money is paid. So I have a much greater comfort in those. And that's something that the DOJ has not only looked at, but frankly opined upon in multiple opinion releases, even when it was an instrumentality of a foreign government as well.
Right. As opposed to money going into the treasury of a foreign country. It's a great point.
Well, James, unfortunately, we are near the end of this episode, but we're going to link to the March newsletter in the show notes. And I greatly look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks so much, Tom. Always a pleasure.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. If you're interested in history, specifically the Greek and Roman period, I hope you will check out the special podcast series Richard Lummis and I are running on 12 O'Clock High, a podcast on business leadership. We're taking a look at Plutarch's lives and bringing it forward for leadership lessons for the 21st century. A fascinating series on one of the seminal biography and textbooks of history. If you're interested in history, biography, Greeks or Romans, I know you will enjoy it. Please check it out.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.